Deutsche Welle Spotlight on Europe.
Hello, welcome to our weekly program Spotlight on Europe, coming to you from our studios in Bonn, Germany. I am Zipporah Nyambura. Coming up, a call to relaunch and reform the European Union.
If ever a moment is good for reform, now is the time, because the EU suffered from a dearth of leadership in recent years. Apart from Angela Merkel, there's been nobody prominent or impressive at the European level. Now we've got Macron, who is quite impressive. So I think chances of reform go up if you have good leaders who can drive it.
The UN climate conference gets underway in Bonn. But just how important is it for Africa? Plus more from Catalonia as confusion rages over its political status. We start off in Spain, which is facing one of its worst political crises in 40 years. It all started when Catalonia issued a unilateral declaration of independence. The Spanish authorities responded by imposing direct rule. The man behind the move, former Catalan president Carles Puigdemont, who was removed from office, has since gone into exile in Belgium, claiming he will be unfairly treated by the Spanish justice system. But what do pro-independence supporters feel about it? Guy Hetchko reports from the town of Sabadell.
Midday in Sabadell, Catalonia's fifth biggest city, and an hour's train ride from Barcelona. Pro-independence feeling is strong here, but with the Spanish government having introduced direct rule, there's a sense of uncertainty among locals.
Do you feel that you're in an independent country in Catalonia?
I feel so. I just want it to be recognised by other countries, because then it would be complete independence for me. But I think we are independent and we just have to have it in a better way.
No, hace falta mucho proceso todavía para llegar a que nos reconozcan.
We've got a long way to go before we're recognized as independent by other countries. I am a Spanish Republican and I don't believe in borders. But because of what has happened and how Spain has treated us and taken away our right to speak out, to have freer or more self-sufficient autonomous powers, I have to say that this Spanish Republican has become a Catalan separatist.
As one of the region's main cities, Sabadell has seen many demonstrations recently against the Spanish state's attempts to clamp down on the independence movement. This one took place in early October, 2 days after the disputed independence referendum, which triggered the current crisis. More recently, people have taken to the streets to demand the release of former members of the Catalan government, who have been jailed pending trial for their role in the referendum and the independence declaration. Víctor Colomer is a local man who has taken part in some of those demonstrations.
We are in the middle of Sabadell, which is the Plaza San Roque Square, the place where are the three big powers of the town. The bank, the finances, the money, Banco de Sabadell. This is a very old bank from 1881. On the other side, we have the church and, of course, the town hall, yes.
But something is missing from the town hall building, as Víctor points out.
On the top of the building, it should be four flags, but the Spanish flag and the European flag have been taken down. What does it mean, that we are in a republic? Well, I don't know, nobody knows. There's lots of confusion about that.
The person responsible for the removal of those two flags is the pro-independence mayor, Matías Serracant. He allowed them to be taken down on October the 20th, when the Catalan parliament declared the region independent.
We took down the flags, the Spanish flag and the European flag, because we think that these symbols doesn't make sense with this moment that we are living in Catalonia.
The European flag was taken down in protest at the EU's refusal to get involved in the crisis, despite appeals from the independence movement for it to do so. But as well as anger, there's also a feeling of caution among separatists like Serracant.
We feel we are in this transition between Spanish state and Catalan Republic, and we are living with uncertainty. No? Each day we analyze the situation and we are just carrying on till perhaps 21st of December, where there will be another election.
That Catalan election has been called by the Spanish government under the powers granted it by the introduction of direct rule in the region. With their leader, Carles Puigdemont, in exile, the pro-independence parties are now preparing their strategies for that election. But while they hope that they could improve on the narrow majority of seats that they won in 2015, one of the parties expecting to make big gains is Ciudadanos, which is stridently anti-independence. Inés Arrimadas is the party's leader in Catalonia, and according to her, recent events have simply exposed the whole independence project as a sham.
It's a huge lie, repeated over and over again, and it has been used in an utterly illegal way by the Catalan government. Everything that has happened has been completely surreal. They declare independence, supposedly, but then trigger elections in line with the Spanish constitution. The Catalan parliament has been dissolved, and they accept that. It's a big lie that has caused a lot of damage to Catalonia. It has caused companies to leave. It has broken up our social coexistence. And what's more, it has given us a tremendously bad image on the international stage.
Arrimadas and the Spanish government hope the December election will deliver a victory for pro-unity parties. But even if it does, there's a feeling that with Catalonia more divided than ever, a long-term solution to this crisis is still far off. Guy Hedgeco, DW, Sabadell.
In Africa, there are many challenges facing the African Union. Dictatorship, the hunger crisis and security, to name but a few. The European Union is also grappling with many problems. For example, the Catalonia crisis, which we've just been hearing about, migration and Brexit. In response, the Centre for European Reform, or CER, a London-based think tank, has just issued a blueprint for change called Relaunching the European Union. So, what are its key proposals? Charles Grant is a director of the CER and spoke to my colleague Helen Sini.
Well, you start with a common agenda and a common recognition that there are lots of problems, but the opportunity is we have a better economic situation. The worst of the refugee crisis is over. We have a charismatic, ideas-full leader, Emmanuel Macron, as the French president. We have a re-elected Angela Merkel who has the authority and wisdom and experience to balance Macron's enthusiasm and his creativity. And so I think the time is right for a serious push for EU reform. But a lot actually depends on France and Germany working together to work out what they want to do. And we've seen some very interesting speeches recently from Emmanuel Macron setting out an agenda for EU reform, much of which, though not all of which, I agree with. And I think a lot will depend on how Germany responds and to what extent Germany buys into Macron's plans for reforming the Eurozone, for example.
But, I mean, obviously it takes more than two dynamic leaders to push through change through such a huge bloc.
It does, that's a fair point. But although Brexit is in many ways very bad for the EU, in one respect it makes life easier, because if you're trying to push forward European integration, in the old days the British would have been there to put their foot on the brake, and they've departed. So if France and Germany can reach agreement, they can do quite a lot on their own to steer the rest of the EU. There is a problem, I think, particularly with their relationship with Poland and Hungary, which is not good. And the Poles in particular don't like Macron's ideas for a multi-tiered Europe, a kind of Europe of concentric circles with a very integrated core in the middle and looser tiers around the edge. That doesn't appeal to Poles, who don't want to be left in a kind of second-class citizen waiting room outside the core of Europe. So there are difficulties, but I think if ever a moment is good for reform, now is the time, because the EU suffered from a dearth of leadership in recent years. I mean, in the old days when I was a correspondent in Brussels a quarter of a century ago, Jacques Delors was there running the commission, very dynamic leader. François Mitterrand in Paris, Helmut Kohl in Bonn, John Major and Margaret Thatcher ran the British government. You had a lot of serious leaders who could take serious strategic perspectives on big questions. We haven't had that leadership in recent years. We have very weak leaders. Apart from Angela Merkel, there's been nobody prominent or impressive at the European level. Now we've got Macron, who is quite prominent and quite impressive. So I think the chances of reform go up if you have good leaders who can drive it.
You just mentioned there a more flexible structure to the EU involving perhaps tiers of membership. How would that work exactly?
Well, obviously, there was already some flexibility in that Denmark has an opt-out from police cooperation in the euro. and Ireland and Sweden are neutral countries. Not everybody wants to be involved in European defence cooperation. So there's already some optionality. But the line that we would take in our report is actually, in the long run, looking ahead, you need much more flexibility. The idea that every single country will join every single EU policy, which is the basic philosophy of the EU with a few exceptions, is not well suited to making the EU viable in the long run, because different countries have different priorities and different interests and may not want to do the same thing. So that's why I think the idea of tiers of membership, the Eurozone is the integrated core and other tiers of countries doing not everything together but some things together, is actually the way forward. This would actually make the EU, I think, viable in the long run if some of the more Eurosceptic countries want to find a happy place in it, like Poland. But also it helps the enlargement process. The EU has not let in a new member since Croatia joined in 2013, and we're at least probably 10 years away from countries like Serbia joining. And if you want to revive enlargement, you have to perhaps contemplate what I would call membership minus, countries joining most policies but not all policies. For example, if the Balkan countries didn't take part in EU policies on free movement, political opposition to Balkan enlargement would rapidly diminish in existing EU member states. I think we have to be a bit more flexible, a bit more creative, and understand that not everybody's going to do the same thing. That's what Macron thinks, and I think he's right to say that.
I mean, presumably any change would take years to agree on and implement. Given, for example, calls for more autonomy and Euroscepticism in many countries, isn't time running out to make the EU more relevant to voters?
It's always an important challenge to make the EU relevant for voters. In fact, support for the EU, perhaps strangely, has gone up in almost every EU country since the Brexit referendum 15 months ago. I'm not quite sure why that is. Maybe people have seen that the Brexit referendum has thrown Britain into a hell of a mess and nobody in Britain quite knows what to do, and investment is declining and so on. Maybe this makes people a bit scared of following the British example. Or maybe the arrival of Donald Trump makes people think they need to hang together rather than hang separately. Or maybe just the fact that the economy is growing better in Europe, that's probably a large part of it. Is whatever the reasons, Euroscepticism is on the wane in most European countries. It's still, of course, an important, powerful factor. So I think you're right. Europe hasn't got that much time to reform, because come the next economic downturn, we may predict that Eurosceptic forces will gather strength again. So the time to reform the EU is now, so that it can be made into a more people-friendly, kind of less unappealing organization before the next downturn comes, and in order to make sure the Eurosceptic forces don't revive too strongly.
Charles Grant, director of Center for European Reform, talking to Helen Sini. More than 20,000 people are here in Bonn for the 23rd annual UN Climate Conference. The COP23 conference, as it's called, is a two-week meeting aimed at strengthening the 2015 Paris Climate Agreement. 196 countries are participating in it, plus the European Union. Fiji is presiding over this year's summit, a tiny island nation which faces an existential threat from global warming. So, what are the goals of COP23? Helen Sini asked Charlotta Lomas from DW's Environment Desk.
Well, the focus of this climate conference, COP23, is really about finalising the International Climate Accord, which was signed in Paris 2 years ago. It's the first time the COP presidency has been held by a country that faces an existential threat. So Fiji, like other small island states, are really on the front line of rising seas and extreme weather. So at the surface, this conference might seem like your regular boring COP, but really there's a great sense of urgency here. The UN World Meteorological Organization this week announced that 2017 is already the hottest year on record. And scientists are warning that time is running out, that we have to urgently transition away from fossil fuels if we really want to avoid catastrophic climate change. And leading climate experts say that what we do in the next 3 years will be critical. So the goal over these 2 weeks is really to figure out the nuts and bolts of the Paris Accord and to finalise the rulebook of how the goals of this deal will be implemented.
So what are the main sticking points then?
Well, accountability and transparency certainly are key topics. So how do we hold countries to account if they don't meet their pledges? And how do we measure transparency, especially for countries like China that don't exactly have the best track record of transparency domestically? Adaptation finance is another key sticking point. So developing countries continue to bear the brunt of climate change, yet they're responsible for just a tiny fraction of the world's greenhouse gas emissions. Whereas developed countries, on the other hand, particularly China, the US and the EU, are the world's top emitters. So the idea is that developed nations have pledged $100 billion to put into the Green Climate Fund, which is set up to basically support developing countries to adapt to climate change. But there are tensions over whether this figure is even enough. And another real big sticking point is that this fund doesn't actually cover loss and damages for the countries affected by climate change.
Well, another sticking point is the fact that earlier this year, US President Donald Trump announced that he would pull the US out of the Paris Accord. Are there signs that this has dampened the mood here at COP23?
Well, quite the contrary, actually. It seems the US withdrawal has had the opposite effect. So even though the US is the world's second biggest emitter, cities and states in the US have announced that they are still in and have pledged to fill the gap in meeting the goals of the Paris Accord on their own, regardless of what the federal government actually does. And what's interesting now is that Syria, a war-torn country, has just signed the Paris Agreement, leaving the US as the only country in the world to refuse the deal. So really isolating the Trump government, which is evident in the fact that there isn't even a US pavilion present here at COP23.
And so are we on track, do you think, to achieve the goals of the Paris Accord?
No. So even if all countries meet their national pledges, we're still looking at a global warming of 3 degrees Celsius. So the goal of the Paris Agreement is to keep warming below 2 degrees, but even at 2 degrees, some small island states will literally disappear under rising seas. So for them, the impacts of climate change are already happening. So at COP23, I spoke with a climate activist from Fiji who really brought this message home in saying that for small island nations like Fiji, 1.5 means staying alive. So the current emission pledges in the Paris Agreement just aren't enough, and we really need to boost ambition if we want to meet the 2-degree target and, more importantly, the 1.5-degree target.
So how do we do that? I mean, what needs to happen in order to prevent the worst effects of climate change?
Well, quite simply, we just have to stop emitting greenhouse gases, particularly carbon dioxide, which means transitioning away from fossil fuels towards renewables. Though some experts say we've reached a point now where we've left it so late that renewables alone won't get us to the 2-degree target, let alone the 1.5-degree target. I spoke with the UN climate chief, Patricia Espinosa, last week, who told me that we have to really consider alternative energy sources as a means to tackling this problem. So that might even mean considering controversial measures like nuclear energy and carbon capture and storage. And while all of this does sound really doom and gloom, Helen, the general consensus is that we still do have a chance to avert the worst impacts of climate change, but we have to act fast.
Charlotte Loma from DW's Environment Desk talking to Helen Sini. Now, Africa is bearing the brunt of climate change with drought and floods threatening livelihoods and killing thousands. According to the UN, temperatures in most African countries will rise over the next years, threatening not just people but also coastal and marine life. I talked to my colleague Ineke Mules, who has been following the talks at the ongoing UN climate conference here in Bonn. And first, I wanted to find out why this conference is important for Africa.
Well, this conference, it's extremely important for African nations. Of course, this year it is being held in Bonn, Germany, but the president is Fiji. And so, of course, a lot of the focus, outwardly at least, is on these island nations and the sort of consequences they will face from climate change. But there is a significant African presence there as well. And a lot of what's going to be happening this year is going to be following on from the Africa Carbon Forum, which was held in Benin earlier this year, which was more or less saying what African nations need to do is figure out a better way to cooperate with one another to decide what the goals are between them, because of course African nations are very different from a lot of other more industrialised countries in terms of what they can and can't put into policy. Everyone's starting from a different level, basically. So African nations are going to make sure their voices are heard, for sure, in this COP23 conference. And it's very likely that there will be some kind of... that they need to show that they can cooperate not only as a continent, but with the rest of the world, and what role they can play there is very important as well.
For many people in Africa, climate change is like something too far away. Like it will happen, but it has not happened.
Yeah.
What do you think African nations, or rather this conference, hopes to tackle such an issue which is threatening African lives?
Well, you're right in the sense that's one of the big problems of climate change in general, is the fact that it's not an immediate crisis necessarily, especially in a lot of African countries where they are dealing with far more immediate crises. I think what they want to point out most of all is the fact that you know, livelihoods are tied to climate change. You mentioned droughts and famine. You've got more than two-thirds of people in Africa who make their living off of the land itself, and we're already seeing the effects of that. So tying climate change to a more immediate concern of how people are going to make their living, basically, that's something that is going to hit home most of all, rather than just speaking about, you know, in 50 years' time you're going to have this amount of degree difference. You know, what does that mean? What does that mean to these people's livelihoods? And I think getting more to the point and driving it home is what is going to be important in this conference.
When we talk about climate change, we cannot avoid talking about Donald Trump, because the US pulled out of climate change this year. Do you think this conference will tackle the problem of poor nations not having enough funds to tackle climate change?
Actually, yes, that could be a flashpoint issue in this particular conference, and it is a bit of a, it's a contentious issue when people say, because of course a lot of these poorer nations are going to be affected the most, but they're not the ones who put these emissions out necessarily. They are very low emitters. As for the US, the delegation is a lot smaller this year, unsurprisingly, following President Trump's decision. But there is a very high US presence in other areas like business and NGOs, and they have actually, they say, despite the fact that the US as a government has pulled out of the Paris Agreement, or so they say, there is still a very significant business and NGO presence from the US who say they are going to continue to do their bit. So the US pulling out may not actually be as... It's an issue. It's a big issue, but it may not be as major as some people are thinking it could be.
Global warming is said that it will affect mostly Africa. Why?
There are so many factors involved there. In Africa, so many people live off the land. It's incredibly vital to them. So that's a major factor at play as well. Also, Africa is generally, it's already prone to a lot of more extreme weather events, especially drought and famine and flooding in some areas as well. So that is obviously going to be a major cause of concern too. I mean, depending, every area of the world has their own sort of weak spot in terms of, you know, whether they're more prone to flooding or more prone to storms or more prone to drought. But Africa really has everything in a sense.
High temperatures, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. And of course, like I said, you combine that with people needing, you know, they rely on the climate for their livelihoods. Everywhere in the world does to some extent, but Africa in particular. So, of course, they have a very, very high stakes there.
And I was speaking there to my colleague Ineke Mules. The EU is calling for a blacklist of tax havens to be drawn up following the release of the so-called Paradise Papers. Some well-known figures and companies here in Europe have been named in these leaked documents on offshore investments. Neil King has the details in this roundup of European news.
EU finance ministers would like a blacklist of tax havens to be drawn up for approval next month to crack down on tax dodging by the rich and famous. The 28 members of the bloc have been working for more than a year on such a list, which would replace ineffective national ones. But finance ministers are divided over how to impose sanctions on countries that help tax avoidance, which is often legal. And smaller countries such as Ireland, Malta and Luxembourg are loath to scare off major firms headquartered in their low-tax capitals. The tax affairs and offshore deals revealed by the Paradise Papers have proved to be embarrassing for an array of companies and individuals, even if they've not broken the law. Britain's Queen Elizabeth II has apparently placed around £10 million of her private money in funds held in the Cayman Islands and Bermuda. Here in Germany, three banks have reportedly been involved in processing payments for illegal online casinos. And in the Netherlands, the government says it will review 4,000 corporate tax deals to determine if they were properly issued. In Italy, prosecutors have arrested and charged two men with people trafficking after the bodies of 26 Nigerian women and girls were recovered from two shipwrecks in the Mediterranean. The men, a Libyan and Egyptian, are suspected of having skippered one of the boats and were identified by survivors. Prosecutors are investigating whether the women and girls, who appear to have drowned, were victims of sex trafficking. According to Italian media, they were mostly between 14 and 18 years old. Germany's highest court has called on Parliament to recognise a third gender category for people who don't identify as being either male or female. The Federal Constitutional Court has called on lawmakers to enact legislation by the end of 2018 to either allow the introduction of a third category or dispense with gender altogether in civil status documents. Under current rules, Germany allows babies born with characteristics of both sexes to leave the gender options of male and female blank. This week's court ruling will require a new option from birth. Germany's Federal Anti-Discrimination Agency has described the ruling as historic. A restaurant has opened in Paris where diners are asked to leave their clothes at the door. It's the city's first nude restaurant and rather aptly called Au Naturel. Members of Paris Naturist Association attended the restaurant's grand opening, but it's now open to the public. To ensure a bit of privacy from nosy passers-by, the windows and entrance are draped with blackout curtains. Upon arrival, customers strip off in a cloakroom before heading to their table. Local residents are apparently quite relaxed about the new establishment. It's estimated that over 2 million people in France participate regularly in some form of nudism. Au Naturel is Paris's first permanent naturist restaurant, but the idea is not new. In 2016, a naked dinner pop-up in London proved popular, but it's since closed down.
Neil King with that roundup of European news. And that is all we had for you today on Spotlight on Europe. Thank you for listening. Do give us your response or feedback in an email via feedback.africa@dw.com. You can also find us on Facebook on our page DW Africa. Thanks to the rest of the team, Helen Sini, and our technician, Eugen Kuhn. I am Zipporah Nyambura. From all of us here at Deutsche Welle, have a wonderful week ahead.
La merveille et mon côté, échange culturel.